Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. In this episode, you'll learn about the inner workings of the show in a new edition of Late Night Chats. Then you'll hear Seth's interviews with climate scientist Dr. Ben Sonter and author Paul Beatty. Now let's get to the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Henry. I am a segment producer here at Late Night. So here's the deal. Usually at this point in the podcast, you are hearing Seth Meyers' voice. You are hearing a closer look. So we are dark this week. We are on hiatus. So we are recording this actually Thursday, March 2nd. And I'm here with Sal Gentile, a writer, the brains behind the Closer Look segments. And we're just going to talk and we're going to hope that that's interesting to you. This is Late Night Chats with Sal and Henry. Late Night Chats. Okay, Sal, so you write the Closer Looks and you usually write them overnight, pretty much. So I was wondering on a day like today, which is a different today than the today you're listening.
Yeah, we should explain. So today's, people are listening to this, what, next Thursday?
A week from...
It's a Friday.
They know what day it is.
So you know what day it is when you're listening to this, probably.
For us, it's March 2nd.
But when it's being recorded on March 2nd.
Yeah.
Which is...
We just wrapped a show.
Thursday, March 2nd. We just wrapped a show. It's like, it's like 7:45.
Yeah.
So... this was an insane day in terms of
I want to ask
news.
About this. So you write overnight, and then this Jeff Sessions stuff.
Yes.
Jeff Sessions stuff.
So it's so weird to think about. Okay, so today, March 2nd.
Which is not today, right?
Like we're recording some sort of time capsule.
March 2nd is not today.
Today is March 2nd.
Right, but today, their today is different.
Oh, sorry. Yes, yeah. Your today. If you're listening, your today is not.
Our
it's
today.
Not our today. It's a different today. What we just described, I think, is basically the plot of multiple NBC dramas.
This is timeless.
It's a podcast, but it's on a different day from the day that they were listening to
Ooh.
It.
So
today on March 2nd, the main story is obviously that there was reporting that Jeff Sessions had had conversations, a meeting and a phone call, I guess, with the Russian ambassador to the United States, and that he had not disclosed that information during his Senate confirmation hearings when he was asked about alleged contacts between Trump campaign aides and the Russian government. And in fact, he offered that he had not met with any Russians during the campaign. And it turned out that that was not true.
Right. So this story broke about 9 o'clock last night.
On Wednesday, March 1st.
Oh, my God. on Wednesday, March 1st. This story broke about 9 o'clock.
Our last night. You're like 8 days ago.
Who knows, right? Yeah. Were you already writing our today's Closer Look?
Yes. I was already writing the Closer Look for Thursday, March 2nd. In fact, I had already basically finished it. And then this story, as has now been the case, when I sent in my draft, I said, like, here's now the ritual of me scrapping what I had already been writing about to write about new allegations about alleged Russian contacts. But this has happened multiple times where these stories drop at like 9, 10 o'clock at night. So I had already been writing a closer look for Thursday, March 2nd.
Uh-huh.
And
today.
And I was basically done,
and I
had to scrap that draft entirely. I went through a couple phases of like thinking, when the first story first broke, I was like, oh, so maybe I'll address at the top and then sort of like find a way to transition to what I already had.
Yeah.
And then it became clear as the story got bigger and spiraled that it was impossible to, like, the whole closer look had to be about that. So then I just scrapped completely what I've been writing about and started from scratch.
Right.
Writing something about sessions in Russia at like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah. That seems like a weird, tricky thing to do when you're writing about Trump, knowing what becomes the bigger story with Trump. Yeah. Like with the Sessions thing, is it something you lead with or is it the whole story?
Yeah.
You've got to make that call.
It's very hard. It's very hard. We've had to, we've just had to be very flexible.
Yeah.
You know, we're adding a lot of stuff day of.
Yeah.
We're just trying to be as nimble as possible because things are changing constantly and we're just trying to get a grasp on what the biggest story is, what people are going to hear about that night, what they want us to sort of like deconstruct and explain to them. It changes very quickly. I mean, I think in this case, it was pretty clear once the session stuff happened that was going to be the predominant story.
Absolutely. Yeah. I thought we could talk a little bit about our shared work history.
Sure.
We've worked in the same office three times. The first was Manhattan Media. I was an intern / freelance reporter in college at a paper called New York Press.
Oh, yeah, that's right. This is so random.
Well, okay. So you were at, what paper were you at?
So I was a reporter. I had a day job. First, my day job out of college was I was a reporter for these like local newspapers called they were called City Hall and the Capitol.
Yeah, yes.
And they were basically like Politico for New York.
Mm-hmm.
So Politico, for those who are not aware, is,
people know Politico,
right? Everyone knows, but yeah. It's politics centric, and in some ways, even though it's a mess.
Sure.
Market publication, anyone can read it. People who are do not work in politics obviously read Politico. It's a major news outlet. But to some degree, it's also kind of designed, or there are features of it that are kind of designed to the political class, like people who work in politics, people who are interested in political minutia. It's about the everyday workings of DC and national politics. It was like that, but for New York City and New York State politics exclusively. So it'd be like about what's going on in New York City and state government and that kind of thing.
Well, I remember, so I would hear your voice from a few cubicles over, and you'd always go, "It's Sal Gentile. It's Sal Gentile. Hi, I'm calling from whatever the paper was. It's Sal Gentile." And my friend and I were working at New York Press, and we never saw your face, or we never knew which face your voice connected to.
Right.
But we just hear Sal Gentile, Sal Gentile, and we never knew who it was. Then I remember when I was working at Up with Chris Hayes in the same office as Late Night.
Yeah.
It's now in. They were like, Chris one day was like, "Yeah, we're hiring this great local reporter. His name is Sal Gentile." And I was like, "Sal Gentile sounds so familiar." And then you walked in, and that was the first time I made the connection of the name Sal Gentile.
That's
and I remember at Manhattan Media, when I walked in for my interview, one of the newspapers there was Chelsea Clinton News. Do you remember this?
Oh, that's
and
right.
And I was like, either Chelsea Clinton runs a newspaper that I just never knew about, or
I
someone runs a newspaper
that
only about Chelsea Clinton.
That's
and it was
funny.
The neighborhood's Chelsea Clinton. And I ended up writing a couple of stories for Chelsea Clinton News.
It was her newsletter.
It was her newsletter. Yeah. I honestly thought Chelsea Clinton had like a small little newspaper. Just like, today I went wherever.
God. That's really funny.
And then, so this is a podcast. Newsletter are they're an audio format. But if you could see this room right now, Sal and I kind of look like vaguely similar, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we,
I remember
we kind of always do.
Once we were walking down the hall right outside would become Late Night offices, and there was an NBC tour group, and this kid turned and looked at us, because everyone in a tour group wants to see famous people, and they turned to look at us, and this kid went, "Are you guys famous?" And we're both like, "No, sorry." And he went, "Are you twins?"
Oh my gosh.
We're like,
yeah, we got
double
burned by some punk on a tour group.
Yeah.
If you have to ask, "Are you famous?" then those people are not famous.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's weird. To explain to people, we worked for a show called Up with Chris Hayes, which was on weekends. It was sort of a roundtable political discussion show.
We'd get in at like, 5 in the morning?
Yeah, it was insane. It was horrifying.
It was insane.
It was really terrible.
No, it was fun.
The show was really fun and great. No, the show was great.
The hours were insane.
The hours were absolutely horrible.
Yeah. It was this weird thing where you would get a cab into the office. In the very beginning, we'd get in at like 4. And there's this very strange thing where I'd go to sleep pretty early on Friday night and then get up at like,
right, because the show's on from 8 to 10 on Saturdays
and
Sundays.
Yeah,
8 to 10 in the morning.
And I remember, it's this weird thing where you get in a cab and you'd go up 6th Avenue to 30 Rock, and there would be people leaving bars. And it was like, oh, it's still last night for you.
Yeah.
I'm in the next day.
Yeah,
it was this bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we would have kind of like Wednesday through Sunday schedule, basically.
Yeah.
Our days off were like Monday and Tuesday.
Right.
And you couldn't have a Friday. You had to go to bed somewhat early on Friday because you had to wake up at like 5 in the morning.
And then work all day Saturday.
Work all day Saturday. You had to go to bed on Saturday too because you have to be up on Sunday. It was a weird schedule. I remember the first time I worked there for almost exactly a year.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I went out on a Friday after that. It was
oh
like,
my gosh,
it was
I remember it too.
One of the best feelings of my life.
Absolutely.
It was incredible.
I am never someone who stays out late, just like
generally.
So the job was actually kind of fitting, but I remember going out with friends that night and it was like 2 and I was like, what's the next bar?
Yeah.
And they're like, first of all, shut up.
I just walked around in awe of the fact
just to
that
do
there
it.
Were people out and about and I was with them. It was really crazy.
Yeah.
So while I had that day job, the reporter job that I randomly worked at, and then continued.
Where I heard you working.
Yeah. That was when I also started taking classes at UCB,
mm-hmm.
the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York. And then by the time I was working for Chris Hayes, that was like my day job. And at night I would go to, I was on both a house sketch team and a house improv team at UCB. So I had this sort of double life.
Yeah.
And I weirdly specifically, it was like this weird, I guess looking back now, it was almost kind of like a premonition. I remember somehow Seth Meyers came up
mm-hmm.
at work and the fact that he was getting his own late night show at some point. And I remember thinking, oh man, that would be so cool to work there.
Yeah.
And it turns out
it's not.
I really wish
sucks.
I could.
And then that's, yeah.
Yeah. That's the moral of the story is that I was so wrong.
But that's so funny. Yeah. And it's so weird to me that we are in the same offices.
That's the thing is like, not only was I just sort of idly wondering like, oh, I wonder if I could work there.
Yeah.
But then also, and then I ended up working there in the same place that I had been working at the time when I was like, oh, I wonder if I could work there.
Yeah. When I came to interview, it was like,
yeah, we have the same, just again, people might not understand this. Those offices used to be MSNBC offices. That's why Henry and I worked there.
Yeah.
And then MSNBC was moved for Late Night with Seth Meyers. So it's the exact same place in 30 Rock, in 30 Rockefeller Plaza.
I was very lucky. I knew you because I left MSNBC, went to a show called Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell.
Mm-hmm.
For the second season, and it was on FXX.
Yeah,
It was a really fun job, but it just got canceled 3 or 4 months after. And then I was looking for jobs, and I had an interest in architecture. had literally never taken a class in architecture, just was interested, and applied one day to a place, a small architecture newspaper.
Yeah,
and ended up working there for a year and a half, which was definitely longer. It was so weird. I was writing about like. I was doing a lot of writing on like urban policy and affordable housing. That was interesting. But then I know like a lot about like permeable paving systems and like doors and wind and like glass. And it's just this weird thing.
Knowledge that almost certainly will never come in handy for you ever again in your life.
If we have like a...
will never be applicable.
No. Ever. We're never going to have a guest on that does like...
Yeah.
Like shades.
And you're certainly not going to design anything. Or maybe you will.
No, I'm not going to.
Okay.
We're going to have like a landscape architect on to talk about like stormwater retention. Which I've written literally like a thousand articles on like.
Or like land use procedures.
ULURP.
ULURP. I said ULURP without knowing that anybody knows what that means.
No, you can Google it. Yeah. And then you were very lucky. You were very nice. You emailed me and were like, there's a job opening at late night. And I was like, I work at an architecture newspaper. There's no way.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder where you and I will end up next.
I know.
You'll be there first.
I will be the tip of the spear.
So wherever you go next, I'm just going to wait. And then just, I'll end. I'll just.
Yeah. First, when I show up, I'll case the place for whatever, wherever Henry's role is.
Yeah.
Although the way things are going, I think I'm going to be here for the next 30 years. And it's just going to be Trump's going to be president for 30 years.
It does.
I'm
going to
live
like,
this nightmare forever.
I remember a few weeks ago I asked you, I was like, so it was some insane Trump news that happened that now feels like ancient history. But I was like, oh man, you must have been up so late last night. What time did you go to bed last night? And you looked at me and went, what? Last night? No. Yeah. I went to bed this morning, 6 a.m. This morning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
That's been happening a lot. It was funny because there was like...
the way you say that, yeah. I go to sleep in the morning.
Yeah. I had a weird like 2 week period, not last week, the week before, where I was getting my work done at a pretty decent time, like a pretty regular time, like 10, 11 o'clock at night. And then I'd send in my draft and then we would work on it the next day. But I was able to go to bed at a normal time. And now news is just breaking constantly.
It's insane.
At like a late... at like 10 o'clock. And
yeah.
So.
Oh, man. Doing a great job, though.
Thank you.
I'm sorry it's taking years off your life. The years the years you are living are very fruitful. And you've done great things. I'm sorry.
But I'm living like 3 years and 1 year now.
Exactly, yeah.
So that, but that time is coming off the end. Like, they take that time off the end of my life.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
sure.
So right now it's like every day feels like 10 days.
Right.
But then what happens is they take 10 days off the end of my life to make that one day feel like 10 days.
Yes.
It's kind of an exchange. Like, it's not...
No, I understand.
It's a zero-sum game. You're not living a 10-day one day and then getting 10 days at the end of your life as well. Like, you're losing that time at the end.
Again, is it based on today or...
Sorry, we're talking about 8 days ago today. We're
talking about
Thursday,
Sorry.
March 2nd.
So the time between this podcast...
I don't
know
why I keep saying 8 days. I'm building in an extra day because I assume people... Like, I have this fantasy of people going, oh, the late night podcast is out. I'll listen to it tomorrow. I don't know why that's in my head.
Everyone waits a day.
Yeah, waits a day. So I keep saying really, 8 days.
I just want to experience...
You got to let it cool off or something for a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Sal, thank you for this is very fun. Apologies. Apologies. It's not Seth. Just like to the listeners.
Oh, I thought you were apologizing to me.
Well, sure. You too, maybe. I don't know.
That I wasn't talking to Seth.
Sorry, you're not talking.
Yeah. Apology accepted.
That's one of the your demands now. You only talk to Seth direct. You only talk to Seth.
Uh-huh.
You won't talk to other people on staff. You only talk to Seth.
Yeah,
that's
weird. Seth has to communicate for me to other people.
Yeah. It's hard. He's a totally chill, down-to-earth guy.
Very, very chill about it. Very chill about it. He's willing. He's like, if that's what you need to do for your process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, this has been productive.
This has been.
We've had a productive meeting.
It's been productive, yeah.
Guys.
Who am I, guys?
That's podcast joke. It's a podcast joke.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come on. Who are your guys? Who are your crew? Come on, the podcast community. I feel like five people listening to this will get that.
Sal, it was so much fun talking to you.
Great talking to you, Henry.
This has been Late Night Chats with Sal and Henry.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at itunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Our guest is a climate scientist who has spent the last 25 years studying the effects of climate change at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Ben Santer, everybody. Very excited. Our first climate scientist on the show.
I'm honored.
Good. I'm honored to have you. I want to start by saying this, though. You work at a national lab, but you want to stress that you are here tonight as an individual, as a private citizen. Why is that important for you to make that distinction?
These are strange and unusual times, and it seems kind of important to talk about the science that we do. But I'm not sure how the folks who fund my research will feel about that, so it just seems kind of safer to do it this way.
Right. For tonight, you're just a rogue scientist. Yeah. You mentioned interesting times. Obviously, you're going from President Obama, who believed this was a serious issue. Now we have a president who has called climate change a hoax. You have a new head of the EPA who has sued the EPA multiple times in the past. How does it feel right now to have what you do for a living challenged in this way?
It feels tough. Imagine, if you will, that you spend your entire life trying to understand one thing, and that thing is the cause of change in the climate system. Best of your ability, you do that. And then someone comes and dismisses everything you've understood, all of that scientific understanding, as a hoax, as a conspiracy, as worthless, as a contrived phony mess. You have a choice. What do you do with that? You can either retreat to your office, close the door, and be silent, or you can choose to push back against ignorance and say, hey, this is not our understanding. We know something about the causes of climate change.
And this has been something, obviously, you've been doing this for 25 years. In 1995, you authored 12 words. Is it right that this was basically 12 words that changed the way we thought about climate change? Can you tell us what those 12 words that you put into this report were?
They're forever engraved on my memory. So those 12 words were, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. And it really was the first time that the international scientific community spoke with one voice and said, hey, we've looked at the evidence. Most of it is pointing in one direction. Humans are no longer innocent bystanders in the climate system. We're active agents of change.
You mentioned you authored those words. People are very upset that you put those in. There's obviously industries that would prefer American or humans to be the innocent victims so that we wouldn't have to change our behavior to prevent it from happening. You had some threats. You were threatened by people who were upset about those 12 words.
Words matter. Words can change the world, and it's kind of weird to think, looking back over the last 21 years or so, since that sentence came out, that those words changed the world. And they led to congressional investigation. They led to a dead rat on my doorstep. Dead rat on the doorstep.
Do they knock, or do you just find it in the morning? I'm very curious about this.
I was at home. It's okay. About 10 o'clock at night. There's a knock on the door. I'm upstairs with my son. I go downstairs, dead rat on the doorstep, guy driving away at high speed in a yellow Hummer.
Okay.
I call the police. They tell me, look out for people driving yellow Hummers, which I have done diligently ever since then.
Especially if they got a trunk full of dead rats. I want to talk about this because I had a Senator Ted Cruz on the show, and we were talking about climate change, and he said something, and again, he's a very smart guy, and of course, I did not have any research to debate what he said. I'm going to play what he said on this show, and then I'm going to let you answer to it. Let's take a look.
Many of the alarmists on global warming, they got a problem because the science doesn't back them up, and in particular, satellite data demonstrate for the last 17 years, there's been zero warming, none whatsoever.
Okay, so the best I could have done then was, nuh-uh, but I'm going to turn it over to you. Satellite data, no change, 17 years. What do you have to say to you? What do you have to say for yourself, you alarmist?
Or warmest is a word in vogue.
Is that a climate change scientist joke?
Yeah.
Warmest.
So he made a testable claim on your show.
Yep.
Listen to what he said. Satellite data, so satellite measurements of atmospheric temperature, show no significant warming over the last 17 years. And we tested it. We looked at all of the satellite data in the world from all groups and wanted to see, was he right or not? And he was wrong. Even if you focus on a small segment of the now 38-year satellite temperature record, the last 17 years, he was demonstrably wrong. More importantly, if you look at the entire record, it shows strong evidence of a human effect on climate. Warming of the lower atmosphere, cooling of the upper atmosphere, and that's the fingerprint of human-caused changes in heat-trapping greenhouse gases. So the bizarre thing is, Senator Cruz is a lawyer. He's got to look at all of the evidence when he's trying a case, when he's involved in a case, not just at one tiny segment of the evidence.
I think you have a different estimation of lawyers than I do as far as what they're trying to accomplish. But I want to finish with this. Obviously, this is a scary time. It's an interesting time, as you've called it. Yet you remain optimistic, and I was happy to hear that. But where are you finding optimism right now, considering the sort of deck that's stacked against you?
Well, it seems like a real teachable moment. Climate science has been elevated in public discourse. Look at that. Look at Senator Cruz appearing on your program making testable claims. The President of the United States saying nobody really knows the causes of climate change. And we do. So this is a moment when people are willing to listen. When I can come on your show and say, nobody really knows is wrong. It's fake news.
Yeah.
So what I want those teachable moments. I want to tell people, this is our understanding. These are the likely outcomes if we do nothing about the problem of human-caused climate change. And let's have a respectful, honest debate on what to do about it. But let's not dismiss this incorrectly as a hoax or a conspiracy. We all lose if we embrace ignorance with open arms.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and thank you so much for making the time. It's fantastic to have you here. Dr. Ben Santer, everybody. We'll be right back. That was great.
Hey, everyone. This is Henry from Late Night. I am backstage with Dr. Ben Santer, who is just on set with Seth talking about climate change. You've been very interested in climate and science for a long time. I have to ask you about your thesis, which makes zero sense to me. Your thesis was on the regional validation of general circulation models. What does that mean?
WTF, yeah.
WTF, yes.
So these are computer models of the climate system, and the idea is that you try and simulate the climate of planet Earth, the atmosphere, the ocean, circulation of atmosphere and ocean. And my job back then for my thesis was to figure out how good are these computer models of the climate system.
Gotcha.
And to compare them with actual observations. And in that case, the observations were surface pressure patterns. And I used a particular statistical method, Monte Carlo method, to figure out how good the models were, how faithfully they captured real-world patterns of surface pressure.
Let me ask you this. Weather and climate are obviously two very separate things.
Yeah.
But can people just talk to you regularly about the weather, or do you get so excited and start talking about kind of the underlying aspects of rain or sun or something like that?
Well, when people talk about weather, there's reason for a discussion. Mm-hmm. Take California at the moment.
Right, where you're from.
All these huge pineapple expresses, these atmospheric rivers hitting California, dumping a lot of water in the state at the moment. So that's weather. But one of the things we do and have done is we've looked at this relationship between human-caused changes in greenhouse gases, warming, and how much moisture the atmosphere can hold. So it turns out that a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. Mm-hmm. And for every 1 degree Celsius warming of the lower atmosphere, you get about a 7% increase in atmospheric moisture. So that means that has consequences then. When these pineapple expresses hit the West Coast, for example, we want to know, are they dumping more water? Are these things going to become more frequent as we warm and moisten the atmosphere? So you can have a discussion from weather to what are the long-term changes in the amount of water in the atmosphere.
Right. So if someone says it's going to rain on Thursday, you've got a lot to say about that.
Well, it's a teachable moment.
It's a teachable moment.
Like I
right,
tried to
exactly.
say out there, you're always trying to find innovative ways of explaining these distinctions between weather, you know, day-to-day fluctuations in the stuff we get, in the weather we get, and climate, which is essentially the long-term statistics, the average of weather over a very long period of time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all of your teachable moments, and come back soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next guest is a New York Times bestselling author whose novel, The Sellout, won the 2016 Man Booker Prize. Please welcome to the show, Paul Beatty, everybody. How are you?
I'm all right.
All right, good.
Yeah.
You're good?
Yeah,
right.
I think so.
All right, good. I promise this will be great.
All right.
So I want to ask, this book is fantastic.
Thanks, man.
Glowing reviews, and so many of the reviews refer to it as a satire.
Yeah.
But I've heard that satire is not a word you love to have your book described as.
Yeah, I just kind of just write, you know. I'm not trying to be funny necessarily. It's just how I think. And I don't know, the satire comes with a big burden, you know, the Mark Twain kind of.
Sure.
You have to be witty. You got to wear a seersucker suit all the time.
And I think you're right. Satire feels very considered as opposed to funny, which seems very natural.
Yeah.
Because you, obviously, you're fine with the book being funny.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah. And I would agree with you. I mean, the funny parts to me were laugh out loud funny as opposed to, it strikes me, and I'll move on to the next thing. This is a book about race relations, and it seems like probably that issue is why people want to call the funny parts of it satire.
Like they're afraid to say what it's...
Maybe.
Yeah.
But you've said that you feel like race relations, people don't, they only want to talk about it retrospectively as opposed to contemporary.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by that?
I don't know. I think, you know, I think about like 12 Years a Slave and these other books and even visual art, it's always about stuff that's in the 50s and the 60s or, you know. antebellum kind of things. And nothing is contemporary about stuff that's kind of problematic, that's difficult, you know? And it's either funny. I mean, it's one of the things that I kind of liked about Moonlight, is it kind of just looked at these issues in a, even though that's in flashback a little bit, but it's, sure. You know, it's at least it's set in a modern contemporary setting, you know?
Well, I guess to some degree, when you see something like 12 Years a Slave, you're allowed as an audience to say, well, thank God it's so improved.
Yeah, yeah.
But you write about, obviously, a very contemporary way that forces people to look at it and I think judge it as being what it is. But the interesting thing is that you wrote it, you know, it came out in 2015.
Yeah.
I can only imagine how long it took you to write.
Yeah.
The perspective of it has changed so much in a Trump administration. Has that been strange to you, how people...
Not really. It's interesting for me about, like, when things are timely and when they aren't and who they're timely for. And for me, it's just, I'm just writing. It's my version of how I see life. And, you know, it took me 5 years to write the book. And I think often, it's not just writers of color, but when people write stuff that's difficult, I think people, like, it's easy to pretend, like, you know, I just... Can you say... on television?
Yeah, you can do it. Yeah, go for it.
So, you know, I think, like, people just act like, oh, I saw the election, I just pressed this button and this book out.
Right, right.
And then so, but no, it took a long time and it's...
Yeah. No, I think that's very fair. It's not...
Yeah.
Having read it, I felt there was no involved.
Good.
I felt like...
There's some bull involved.
Yeah, there's a little bull. But yeah, done very well. I want to ask, this I think is a great service. You teach at Columbia.
I do.
And you teach writing.
I do.
And on the first day, you told your students that you hate writing.
Yeah, those were the first words out of my mouth, the very first class I taught. And I had some students actually come up after me and go, I can't, you scared the out of me. You
yeah.
know? You know, when you said that. But, you know, it was the first time I taught, and I didn't know what to tell them, but that's as close to a truism about writing for me
yeah.
that I have. And it's a difficult process, you know. It's hard. Language is tough. And, you know, using the right words is so important to me. And, it's hard. You know, it's hard to put your thoughts on paper. It's really hard.
But I think that's, that is a great piece of wisdom to give, you know, aspiring writers, is that this is going to be hard.
Yeah.
And that more often than not, and I feel this way too, you know, it's great to finish writing, but yeah. actual writing
yeah.
sucks.
Yeah, no, it's yeah. And there's a friend of mine who's a very good writer, and he puts these books out, like, every 2 years he writes a great book. I don't know how he does it, but he tells himself that he's a completionist, not a perfectionist,
uh-huh.
which is fine, but I labor.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't think it's easy for him either, but...
Well, everybody has their own process, and
yeah.
I will say, whatever your process is, it was very effective for
Thank
this book.
Thank you, man. Thanks.
I really enjoyed it, and congratulations on all the accolades, and thanks
for being
here.
Thank you.
Also, everyone in the audience tonight is getting a copy of The Sellout to take home with you. It's fantastic.
Hi, I'm Bea. I'm a producer here at Late Night. I'm here with Paul Beatty. We're going to ask him a few more questions. Do you like talking about your writing?
No.
Why not?
I never know what to say about it, and I don't really remember what I write, so
really?
Yeah, it's kind of a pain in the butt.
So it's trouble. Do you have to go reread the book before you do a press tour?
No, I don't do that.
Okay.
I mean, I have a general sense, but I really kind of don't know, and I'm not very good at summing things up.
Well, we won't ask you what the book is about.
All right,
but...
good.
You mentioned with Seth that you're a teacher at Columbia. What's both the best and worst thing about teaching writing?
That's a good question. It's a really good question. The best thing is the students and watching them improve. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learn a ton. That's also really good. That's the best thing. What's the worst thing? Just that you have to show up, you know. But once I'm there, it's fine.
Yeah, you're a writer. You're meant to be at home all
yeah.
the time if you want. And I know that you started off as a poet. You've obviously written novels now. Which form do you prefer? Which do you find easier?
Well, neither of them is easy, but
sure.
I prefer writing fiction.
Why?
Just gives me more satisfaction. Yeah.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
To be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.